You are listening to Money on the Left, the official podcast of the Modern Money Network Humanities Division, presented in partnership with Monthly Review Online. Reverend Delman Coates holds a Master's in Divinity from Harvard and a PhD in New Testament and Early Christianity from Columbia University. He currently serves as Senior Pastor at Mount Enon Baptist Church in Clinton, Maryland, and is founder of Our Money, an organization fighting to restore democratic control over the financial system. We were excited to speak with Dr. Coates for this episode about how he teaches modern monetary theory to the over 10,000 members of his congregation, about his call for a new theology of economics, and his efforts to unite the traditions of the Black Church and the Civil Rights Movement with the fiscal and policy frameworks of MMT. Be sure to check out his essay titled The Unfinished Work of the Civil Rights Movement, published recently in Sojourner, which is linked to in the show notes. Then head to OurMoneyUS.org to learn more about their work and about how to get involved. Thanks as always to our production team, Alex Williams, Richard Farrell, and Megan Soss for bringing this episode together. Delman Coates, welcome to Money on the Left.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be a part of this conversation.
We're delighted to have you. To start off, could you tell us a little bit about your spiritual, educational, and professional background?
Right. Well, I'm originally from Richmond, Virginia, and I'm a product of a small Black Baptist church in the inner city of Richmond, Virginia. I grew up in the church, going to church probably 4 to 5 times a week. And my journey towards pastoral ministry in many ways was shaped by an image I saw every time I went to church. My church was surrounded by 2 housing projects, the city jail and the juvenile detention center. And every time I went to church, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a week, and I mean that quite literally, I would see images of teenage boys locked up behind a barbed wire fence outside on their recreational time, and Black men behind fences on their recreational time as well. And as I mentioned, surrounding our church was 2 housing projects. And so I wrestled my entire life with the relationship between my faith community, our church, and the social and economic realities outside of our church. When I was a teenager, at one point, you know, I became convinced that the theology, mission, and ministry of the church had to relate to the broader social, economic, and political realities outside of the church. That the gospel that I heard preached every week, that the messages I saw in scripture had something to say about the pain and the poverty and the pathos that I saw on a daily basis as I went to church. And when I became, I would say around 17, I really felt a calling to the pastoral ministry, to be a leader and work towards relating the ministry of the church to, you know, everything that was happening around me. And in many ways, that shaped and informed my call to ministry, my understanding of religion and theology is decidedly shaped by this sense, this imperative that we have to be relevant to the broader social and economic realities that are happening in our world today. When I went to college my freshman year at Morehouse College, I was introduced to what we call then the social gospel, right? So this formal theological tradition of American Protestantism, which is oriented towards relating the faith of the church to a range of social ills that are happening. And the most famous, communicator of the social gospel out of Morehouse is certainly the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., whose birthday we celebrate every year. And that really shaped me in a profound way. And so my formal theological education began at Morehouse College, this all-male, predominantly African-American institution in Atlanta, Georgia, that shaped my formal training toward to ministry. I left there and went to Harvard Divinity School, where I was really intent on being a university professor at that time, and started preparing to do a PhD in biblical studies. If you know anything about that kind of academic work, the philological training and background is pretty extensive. And so when I went to Harvard, I spent a great deal of time during my master's program doing the linguistic and philological training to prepare me for the PhD. And ultimately did the PhD upon completing my master's at Columbia University, did a PhD in New Testament and Early Christian Origins. And over the course of my, graduate education, really felt that the academy was not going to be my terrain of struggle. I really became convinced that I wanted to use the best of my gifts and training and background and passion to the institution that produced me, and that's the Black Church. And I wanted to bring the best of academia to serve her, that is the Black Church. Now, I want to say something for a minute about what I mean by the Black Church. What I mean by the Black Church is that subset of African-American Christian spirituality that has historically been on the side of the fight for freedom, justice, and equality. I say that because not all churches of Blacks are committed to the Black Church tradition of freedom fighting. It's the Black Church that helped to bring down, helped to end slavery, to end Jim Crow segregation, and was a critical part of a range of other freedom movements in America. And so I come out of that tradition. I'm committed to trying to further that tradition, and have done so as a part of my pastoral ministry in Clinton, Maryland, at Mount Enon Baptist Church, where I've been serving for the past 16 years. We've grown from about 1,500 to almost 10,000 in the last 16 years. And in large part, it's been because we've brought together the best of African and African-American sacred spirituality and the best of the social justice, social gospel tradition of the African-American church. And so ours has been a ministry of public engagement. I've been a leading voice on a range of progressive causes, whether it's been fighting for, universal health care, LGBTQ rights, addressing mass incarceration, marijuana legalization, range of other issues. And I'm really delighted to continue that work as a part of this economic justice campaign that we started in May of 2019. So that's a bit about my journey.
Cool. And so before we get specifically into the tenets of the economic justice campaign, could you, for a moment, speak more about your commitment to liberation theology and the long civil rights movement, perhaps even with reference to your interesting doctoral project titled Resistance Reading, Reconsidering the Functions of Early Christian Allegory, that you mentioned as a part of your work at the Harvard Divinity School?
Yeah. So my understanding of the witness of Jesus as articulated in the tradition of the scriptures is that his ministry and movement was largely a movement of social, political, economic, and spiritual liberation. That for me is framed by passages of scripture found in, for example, Luke chapter 4, verses 18 through 21, where Jesus talks about being anointed to preach the good news to the poor, to set the captives free, and to preach the acceptable year of the Lord's favor. And so for me, liberation is foundational to how I read the scriptures. It is the overriding hermeneutic that informs how I read the text of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. And while, you know, that can include, you know, certain notions of individual personal piety, for me, it is difficult to separate personal piety from social and economic salvation as well. I actually believe that salvation understood holistically in the scriptures, both in the Hebrew Bible and in the Christian Testament, are fundamentally about communal salvation, about the redemption of our society, and not just the liberation of souls. This is very important because there's been this long tradition in the West, particularly that tradition that supported the transatlantic slave trade and colonialism in Africa, that really tended to separate, had this sort of ontology that separated, people's individual spirits from the society in which they lived. It enabled European missionaries and white Christians in America to have no problem proselytizing Africans, baptizing Africans on the one hand, and enslaving them on the other hand. There's this very interesting image. If you go to West Africa or Ghana, West Africa, for example, to see the slave castles there in Ghana, where when you go down to the slave dungeons in, let's say, the Elmina castles and Elmina coast, you see you experience this, the horrors, where the places where African bodies were put in chains and then shipped off to the so-called New World. And then you come right upstairs from these slave dungeons and there are these churches, right? And so it's this interesting contradiction between the incarceration, the enslavement of bodies, and the liberation of souls. Well, I believe in a much more integrated, holistic spirituality, one that sees a connection between our spirits and our bodies and the society in which we live. And so for me, it's very foundational and fundamental to how I think about religion, not just my own faith tradition, but, you know, all faith traditions, and even those who don't have a professed faith tradition. What I affirm as a Baptist is people have freedom of and from religion. And so I see, I don't believe that, you know, Christians have a monopoly on God, or monopoly on heaven, for lack of a better term. But I see the hand, you know, the move of the Spirit expressed in a range of faith traditions and expressions. I just happen to be located in a particular place, but in that place, liberation is foundational for me.
So maybe we can turn now to your recent activism and thinking about modern monetary theory. I'm curious, how did you find your way to this thinking and this growing community? What has your learning process been like? And then in addition, what's it like to minister to a congregation and beyond with modern monetary theory in mind?
Yeah. Well, there are probably various phases of this work. You know, if I think about my formative years as a child and as an undergraduate in college, you know, you're always wrestling with, why is there so much economic poverty in the world, right? I mentioned that my church was surrounded by two housing projects and the city jail and the juvenile detention center. And, you know, there are a range of responses or interpretations or analysis for why there's the kind of social and economic pain and poverty that we experience in Black communities in America. And, you know, I've socialized around a range of those ideologies that can span from, you know, these very conservative ideologies that tend to imply that, you know, people just lack certain morals, lack a kind of work ethic. And if they would just, you know, have better morals and work hard, right, then they could enjoy, you know, the good life. You know, perspectives on the other end of the spectrum that may talk about the need to kind of overturn certain capitalists, you know, capitalism, right? And, you know, and sort of have a kind of standard Marxist critique of structure and superstructure. And, you know, the reason that there's all this poverty and inequality in the world is because, you know, of capitalism, right? Well, about 11 years ago, as a pastor, I began to notice that there was an uptick in the number of people coming to my church needing emergency assistance because they were being evicted from their homes. Our congregation provides emergency assistance up to a certain amount if we can help people avoid eviction or foreclosure. And I saw a huge uptick in that number around 2007, 2008. And we know that, you know, this is around the time of the global financial crisis. And, you know, in attempting to respond to this crisis in our community, I think Prince George's County leads the state of Maryland in foreclosures. Maryland was in the top 2 and 3 in the country in foreclosures. I really found myself around 2008, really trying to get into the weeds and trying to understand the global financial crisis. I wanted to understand what was causing so many people to be put out of their homes. And at that time, you know, I was learning about mortgage securitization and collateralized debt obligations and all these kind of things. And I became really burdened and disturbed over time that the very financial institutions that caused the global financial crisis were getting bailed out, but the members of my church were getting put out. And over time, I began to notice that the very institutions that, you know, financial institutions that caused the crisis were 2 and 3 times larger after the crisis than they were before. And this really seemed to be an injustice to me. And, during that time, I recalled someone directing me to a book. I believe it was The Creature from Jekyll Island, if I think about it. Someone told me about The Creature from Jekyll Island, and, you know, I started learning about the history of the Fed, right? And, you know, people, you know, I started learning about money creation. That really kind of started my journey towards understanding money creation. Over time, I really became convinced that the root cause of many of our social and economic crises had a lot to do with how money is created in America. You know, Dr. King has this quote. He says, he's quoting Victor Hugo. It's in the aftermath of the riots. And he says something to the effect, if a soul is left in darkness, sins will be committed. But the guilty one is not the one who commits the sins, but the one who causes the darkness. And King at other times kind of talks about the differences between derivative injustices and causative injustices. And I became very much interested in trying to understand the causative structures that created poverty, inequality, wealth concentration. And I started this journey with a being exposed to a more positive money AMI approach to, you know, monetary reform, for lack of a better term. And over time, I began to feel after I got introduced to modern monetary theory, felt that modern monetary theory provided a very credible, legitimate framework for really thinking about what I think is desperately needed in America. And that is the need to re-legitimize the power of money creation for purposes in the public interest. that if we really want to reclaim our democracy, we do need to have campaign finance reform. We do need to reverse Citizens United. But a part of that movement, in my mind, also needs to entail reclaiming the power of money creation. Because if it is the case that most of what we think of and use as money in our society is created by private interests, private banks when they make loans, that this for me creates a fundamentally unstable foundation for our economy. And to change that, to shift, we need to shift our reliance from money created by private banks through private lending to money created by the public through public spending. And if we do that, we can have a sustainable economy. And after getting introduced to MMT from someone who is now our policy director for the Our Money campaign, Spencer Veal, I was very much interested early on in trying to reduce what I perceive to be the dissonance between a kind of positive money perspective and MMT perspective. I really, you know, believe that modern monetary theory provides the key to unlocking the untapped potential of our economy, so that we can have an economy that works for us rather than against us.
So what's it like to speak to your particular community about MMT? You know, MMT, at least in its most recent formulation, you know, is largely an economics discourse that comes out of, you know, mostly the academy. And, you know, I think that we on this show, being in the academy but outside of the economics discipline, feel the need to develop and grow and complicate that language for our questions and our communities, whether it's with other scholars or with students in the classroom. And I just imagine that ministering in the context of the church, it would present its own kinds of challenges and opportunities to expand the MMT project.
Right. Well, quite to the contrary, I have found it to be a joy, and I have found it to be incredibly, it's not difficult at all. And I think it's because I have really spent my entire professional career trying to figure out how to crystallize, you know, very technical academic concepts, theological concepts, you know, mainly, you know, from my training as a Bible scholar and as a historian of religion, and having to crystallize these concepts in language that a fifth grader could get or that a high school student can get. So it's a part of my training, right, to you know, I don't go in the pulpit as a preacher preaching, you know, the text from, you know, Heidegger or Adamer or Rudolf Bultmann or James Cone. You know, I have to crystallize these concepts using conceptual tools and metaphors that people can find accessible and that they can get, right? And so when it comes to MMT, you know, I really spent, you know, two or three years before we launched the Our Money campaign, trying to think through the best conceptual frameworks and metaphors to help people think about how money, you know, how money should be created, the role, purpose, the public role of money, how to think about what happens systemically when money is created by private banks repayable with interest versus money created by the public purse, the public treasury, the government, you know, without that obligation. I have found the work of Professor Stephanie Kelton, who is actually on the advisory council for the Our Money campaign. If I haven't said it already, the Our Money, our campaign's website is ourmoneyus.org, shameless commercial. But Professor Kelton is on our advisory council. And I think Professor Kelton, you know, really has some awesome tools and frameworks to help make MMT accessible to a more mainstream audience. We do need the technical work. And I know that there have been folks who've been working on the higher level discourse around MMT for 25, 30 years. We all know the names. But if we're going to build a public momentum, sort of grassroots, a grassroots movement to complement the grass tops academic work that's been taking place over the last, you know, quarter century, three decades, then we have to figure out how to develop tools and frameworks, conceptual metaphors that people can get. And I'm presently going around the country doing trainings and workshops for faith leaders, lay people, civil rights organizations, labor groups, wherever I'm invited. And, you know, I go in with a very basic lesson to help people understand at the end of the day that it is preferable to have money created by us and for us, rather than having money created by private interests. You know, I'll start off doing things like I oftentimes will start off using a deserted island illustration. I actually think I got this deserted island illustration from Ben Dyson, actually, where I saw in one lecture years ago, he asked the audience to imagine they're on a deserted island. And on that deserted island, a discussion came about how money should be created for those on the island. And he sort of postulated two or three options. I think one was like the money would be created from the public purse, the public treasury, and everyone would be given an equal amount of money. The second option was that the money would be created from the public purse or the public treasury, and they would pay people for work performed in the public interest. The third option is that there's one enterprising person on the island who says, hey, you know what? I'll create the money for those of us on the island. You guys just pay me a small fee. Let's call it interest for the privilege of creating the money, right? And I asked people in the group to take some time to discuss which of these three options would be the best option. And invariably, the responses are always the same, right? There will be some discussion about the merits of options one and two. Some will say, well, can there be some kind of hybrid between options one and two? But no one ever says, we should allow this private individual to create our money and to charge us interest for the benefit of creating money. And that kind of sets the framework, right, for people seeing that the irony is that even though this is the option that's least preferable, this is actually the kind of system that we've allowed to happen. And if we want to change that, we've got to reclaim the power of money creation through public spending. And so for me, you know, it has not been a challenge or an issue. I think people find it incredibly enlightening because money is the one thing that we take for granted. We think we know where it comes from. We think we know how it's created, but we really don't. And educating people about how money is created, how it functions in our society, and how we can have a more sustainable economy by reclaiming and re-legitimizing the role of money creation. People get it. I mean, we just had a rally in D.C. on Labor Day where 1,000 people, I didn't take a long time to schedule this rally, to plan this rally. We had 1,000 people come out Several of the guys from the Modern Monetary Network came down to speak. We had several organizers and activists to speak on a range of topics. And I find that when you teach people, they get it. They understand how this issue is affecting their lives. And I really believe that the public is, that money is being intentionally obscured, you know, from the public to keep us, to keep money mystified. But when you help, when you explain it in concepts that they can get, that they find accessible, give them, you know, tools to demonstrate certain concepts, they get it. And I haven't found it to be a problem at all.
Do you find some joy in translation, and there's enlightenment in it, and it's being well received? Uh-huh. In terms of the sort of basics and the framework, do you also engage in the sort of history of the you know, job guarantee advocacy that's so central to MMT, mm-hmm. And its articulation with, you know, the civil rights movement and the Black church historically? Does that come
absolutely
up? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. The, you know, I let people understand that the unfinished work of the civil rights movement is economic justice, and that foundational to that work is a fight for a dignified job with benefits for every American that wants one. I mean, many people fail to realize that that march on Washington, the 1963 march on Washington, was a march on Washington for jobs, right? Like, it was not just a march for, you know, racial reconciliation so Black kids and white kids could just, you know, hold hands and sing Kumbaya. No, it was a march for jobs. Coretta Scott King, I believe in the 70s, led 1.2 million people in a quest for a federal job guarantee. Really, a federal job guarantee was one of the core aspects of the nation's first Black female economist, Sadie Alexander. Economist Nina Banks has written a lot about Sadie Alexander. Nina Banks is on our advisory council as well. But back in, you know, as early as the 40s, Sadie Alexander is talking about a job guarantee is one of the best ways of addressing economic insecurity for African Americans, and as a great way to reduce some of the racism and some of the concerns around economic insecurity that whites were feeling as well, right? And so, absolutely, we help people to understand how a federal job guarantee is so critical and necessary today so that people can get better wages. If you've ever gone to your boss to get a raise, well, there's less incentive for private sector employers to increase your wages if there's a whole pool of unemployed people, right, who are willing to take $10 an hour. So we educate people about a federal job guarantee. We educate people about the dual mandate of the Fed was really kind of a settling or a compromise of the push for federal job guarantee, and that we should not seek to balance the economy on the backs of the poor and the unemployed. And so absolutely. And when you talk to folks about federal job guarantee, Medicare for all, free public college, a Green New Deal, and federal funding for more local and state priorities, and you use the framework of MMT, it really gets us out of this common trap that occurs whenever public policies and the public interest are debated and discussed today by those running for office or those who are currently in power. And that one question is, how are we going to pay for it, right? Like, how are we going to pay for Medicare for all? You heard the presidential candidates on the Democratic side, you know, debating whether Medicare for all is, you know, feasible. One candidate says, boasts that their plan just costs $785 billion and how, you know, Bernie's plan is irresponsible because it's going to cost $30 trillion. Well, MMT helps us to understand that we don't have to tax you know, Amazon and Jeff Bezos in order to get public priorities. I mean, we may, you know, there's a role for taxes, but public priorities should not be held hostage to taxing the rich in order to create the money through deficit spending in order to pay for it. I even say that these public priorities don't cost us money. They create money, right? Like, and when you understand that, you understand that a policy like Medicare for All isn't going to cost us $30 trillion. And I really wish candidates pushing some of these policies would really embrace the MMT framework, because these policies are not going to cost us money. It will responsibly create $30 trillion over 10 years. And I say responsibly because deficit spending for the federal government is something to be desired if it's responsibly done. And it's responsibly done as long as we don't exceed the threshold of inflation. Whenever the federal government underutilizes the power of money creation through deficit spending, it causes the public to rely on money created through private bank lending and borrowing. And so I have found MMT to be a very powerful framework to helping us to reimagine what the future can be like. A future where, you know, every American who wants one can have a dignified job with benefits, where we can literally eliminate involuntary unemployment, where we can have single payer health care and not universal health insurance. We can have true health care, single payer health care for every American. We can eliminate student loan debt. We can have free public colleges in America and do so responsibly. By utilizing the power of the public purse. But when you help people to understand that the government, the federal government, does not need revenue first in order to spend, and you show them a range of examples on how that's done in their everyday life, like, God forbid, I'm in an area where there are major military institutions, and God forbid if we go to war tomorrow, but if we were to go to war tomorrow, no one's going to say, where's the money going to come from first in order to fund this war? Do we have to tax Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or William Buffett to get the money for the war? No, we create the money through deficit spending. Deficit spending, properly understood, is net public money creation. And if we can deficit spend, if we can responsibly deficit spend for unnecessary wars, if we can deficit spend to get tax cuts to the rich, we can certainly deficit spend for a range of public priorities that the people care about, to protect our environment, to eliminate mass, to reduce mass incarceration or end mass incarceration in our society and have a sustainable economy.
The sort of tenor of public money creation that you describe really calls to mind what you have called the need to reclaim a theology of economics. And we were wondering if you could ponder this question and this call along the terms of what you seem to be suggesting, which is a tenet of economic creation and public creation, which brings to the four questions of infinity and scarcity, and how this theology of economics perhaps contrasts with those of the past as well as other present theologies.
Yeah. Well, when I talk about reclaiming a theology of economics, I'm principally referring to this tradition of critiquing the private manipulation of money creation that we find in Judaism historically, Christianity historically, and Islam presently. That in these Abrahamic traditions, there's been this historic critique of the manipulation of money. It has, the term that's often used is usury or riba in Arabic in the Islamic tradition. Usury historically was more than just charging excessive interest on loans. The definition of usury as the charging of excessive interest was a definition of interest that the Venetian bankers were able to use to convince the church to give up its historical position that usury is sin. And with the help of some, you know, philosophers at the time, Bentham and others at the time, they were able to kind of convince the church to define usury as excessive interest, which then kind of opened up the door to the church being comfortable with a little interest or some interest. But historically, usury was much broader than that. Usury was about the manipulation and monopolization of the money creation, money power. For example, Thomas Aquinas said that usury is, in the 13th century, usury is the earning of interest on that which did not exist before. And this is very interesting because when you think about how banks create money when they make loans, and that's very important for us to frame this because what is often called lending by banks is really not lending. When people think of lending, they tend to think of the lending of something that already exists. But when banks, quote unquote, lend, they create deposits out of nothing. So deposits don't create the loan. The loan actually creates the deposits. So banks, when they lend, are creating the loan out of nothing. It gets accommodated by Federal Reserve, reserves. The Federal Reserve accommodates the commercial bank lending of banks after the fact. And so banks are literally creating the loans, creating money out of nothing and earning interest on money that they've created out of nothing. Well, there could be nothing more in line with Aquinas's definition of usury as the earning of interest on that which did not exist before. I would contend that's more in line with the historic definition of usury. And it's that stance and that posture, critique of private money creation that I think people of faith need to kind of reclaim and have a critique around. Otherwise, what ends up happening is we get a kind of endorsement of the current economic order that ultimately results in kind of distortions of economics that we see today in the popular church community. You may have heard, your audience may have heard about things like prosperity gospel, where preachers tend to go around legitimizing a theology of wealth and getting wealth almost at any cost without any sort of critique around an understanding of the mechanisms of money creation. So when I talk about reclaiming a theology of economics, for me, it's about reclaiming this historic critique of private money creation that I see in, you know, these Abrahamic religions. A critique that I think is also present in my own tradition, the day before Jesus's crucifixion, where there is this common story of Jesus overturning the tables of the money changers. And what many people fail to realize is that this story is more than just a critique of commerce gone awry. It's a critique of the way in which the money lenders who had set up shop in the temple had monopolized the creation of the temple shekel and left people in more debt and bondage when they left Passover than they had when they came. And I would contend that the overturning of the tables of the money changers was a critique of this private money creation mechanism. And it's that perspective that I think we want to reclaim. We need to reclaim that tradition and that critique.
One of the things that I've heard you say is that despite our many differences, what unites us is our need for and reliance upon money. And this seems to, I think, really transfigure the way in the modern West we typically think of money's so-called universality, right? And the major way that we think of money's universality is as a universal equivalent which makes possible bilateral exchanges between private actors. But this is a totally different kind of articulation of universal connection, and one that probably seems strange or even perverse from a kind of mainstream point of view that sort of sees money as primarily a private wealth-gaining activity. I'm wondering if you can just kind of reflect on that and flesh that out for us.
Well, when I'm starting from the perspective that money is a public utility, not a... So for me, money is fundamentally public in nature. It is a result of our failure to utilize that public power that these private interests then step in and fill a space that the public, has deferred to the private sector. But if we reclaim that public power, that understanding that of the public nature of money, fundamentally public in nature, then it seems to me that it helps to complement, for political purposes, the various identity politics that, in the absence of a unifying meta-narrative that links us, can cause those of us, on the left, all right, okay, this program is money on the left. I think money is for, it's public for everyone, whether they identify as left or not. But
sure.
I think I have found on the left that we're kind of a fragmented fellowship, right? There's, LGBTQIA plus community. There's, Marxists. There's MMT folks. There's, Black Lives Matter folks. There's, Latino X communities, fighting for their, and for me, I've always struggled with what is the narrative, what is that meta narrative that's going to link us to really empower a movement going forward. And for me, it's money, not in a private sense, but understanding money in a public sense that links all of these, disparate identity and identities. And I have found that if we don't have something that links us on the left, we find ourselves potentially vulnerable to the unified forces on the far right. And so for me, the economic framing presented by MMT provides that kind of narrative that can help link, LGBTQIA, movement, Black Lives Matter, those who are fighting to end mass incarceration, those who are fighting for healthcare reform, those who are fighting for a Green New Deal and address our environmental crisis, money, as I understand it, public money, can serve as that narrative that links us.
This seems like a really good time to transition to talking about Our Money. Can you tell us a little bit about what that organization is and what it's after?
Yes. Well, in May of 2019, I launched the Our Money campaign to really mainstream core concepts of modern monetary theory. It's been a long, it's been the evolution. It's the final result of my wrestlings with a range of monetary reform movements. And I've really come to settle in on modern monetary theory, providing the foundational framework for how we're going to move forward. And really, you know, whether there are people who self-identify as MMTers or not, the core concepts of MMT, I believe, are applicable and are unassailable regardless of whether people identify as MMT or not, right? I mean, we see, you know, mainstream economists, right, even on the right saying, hey, you know, deficits don't matter the way we thought they did. Or, you know, the Phillips curve isn't as critical and foundational, you know, as we thought it was, you know, for addressing, you know, unemployment, stuff like that. So we launched Our Money last year to help mainstream a set of core MMT concepts and principles. It's a campaign that in many ways is born out of my own personal ministry and in large part funded by, funded by my congregation. We are right now going around the congregation, around the country rather, doing workshops and sessions with faith leaders, civil rights leaders, lay people, candidates for public office, educating them about the core tenets of modern monetary theory and helping them to understand how it relates to a range of public priorities that are currently on the table. There are a range of robust spending proposals on the table right now, and MMT, I believe, provides the answer to the one question that everyone is asking, and that's how we're going to pay for it. We pay for it by re-legitimizing the power of money creation, because the federal government does not spend, does not need tax revenue in order to spend.
Could you say a little bit more about what those what you're up to in those workshops, and maybe how people can start to get involved with the Our Money Project?
Right. Well, what we're doing in the workshops, foundationally, about educating people about giving people a brief understanding of how it's preferable to have money created through the public purse, the public treasury, or by the government versus having money created by private interests or the banks. Helping them then understand that most of what we think of and use as money is created by the least preferable mechanism, and that's money created through private bank lending. And that if we want to have a sustainable economy, one that reduces private household debt, one that provides a dignified job with benefits for every American that wants one, one that even is beneficial to businesses, because it's in the best interest of businesses for, you know, everyday Americans to have more money than they do have credits or debts, right? If people are way down in credit card debt and school student loan debt, well, then they're not able to, you know, buy shoes or buy food and clothes. And so I believe that this is also, you know, kind of, it's good for businesses. It's good for growth. It's good for people improving the quality of life. And then we kind of walk people through how they can organize in their local communities for a specific set of policy goals right now. Right now, we're trying to move for and trying to push for members of Congress to oppose the PAYGO budget rule, which is a budget rule primarily on the House side right now, largely pushed by the Democratic leadership, that says that for every dollar of spending, there needs to be a dollar of revenue. PAYGO, we believe, is really harmful to America, because whenever the public sector is in surplus, the private sector is in deficit. See, we want public sector deficits, because when the public sector, when the government is deficit spending, then that means the private sector and homeowners and the private citizens have their surpluses. And PAYGO underutilizes the power of money creation and prevents us from funding the things that the public needs. We want people to have their elected officials uphold PAYGO as a budget rule. We want them to ask their elected officials to push for congressional hearings on modern monetary theory, on the Humphrey Hawkins Act, and on regulating financial fraud in the securities industry, and to support policies such as a federal job guarantee, a Green New Deal, which includes a federal job guarantee, Medicare for all, free public college, abolition of student loan debt, and more federal spending for local and state priorities. I mean, this fiscal policy framing is so powerful that even state and local, we can think of a range of other state and local priorities as being funded through federal government spending. Right now in my community and in communities all across the country, state legislatures are meeting this month as they begin their new legislative session, thinking about, you know, which schools to build, which schools we're going to have to let close. We have schools in our community that are literally going to be closing down soon because the county doesn't have the resources, the tax revenue, state doesn't have the money. And so just imagine if the federal government thought about its responsibility to fund local and state priorities in a broader way. If you know, our federal government said, you know, we don't want schools that are 40 and 50 years old, which we literally have in some of our communities in America, where when it gets cold, there's no heat. And when it's hot, there's no air conditioning, where there's still lead in the water. Right. We want schools, you know, that should be rebuilt over 25 years old. Like if we can build new ballparks in cities across America, we certainly ought to be able to rebuild, you know, America's crumbling schools. And we'll pay for it not through local and state revenue, but we'll pay for it through federal deficit spending, public spending. The possibilities are literally endless. And, you know, this is fundamentally what we're doing when we're going around the country on these, you know, with these sessions right now.
Well, Pastor Delman Coates, thank you so much for coming on Money on the Left.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really delighted to be a part of this conversation and look forward to working with Money on the Left going forward.